Welcome to the Middle East Report, your connection to truthful reporting on Israel and the Middle East. Each week, we connect you to the people, places, and geography in the land of Israel and around the Middle East. And of course, we keep you informed of the current events that are happening in that part of the world. And as always, there's a lot going on. Today, we are going to talk about something historical, amazing, that was a miracle in Israel. And it was the 1967 war. We're going to find out about that. We're going to find out about a very special place in Israel that you can go to remember the 1967 war. So a lot of you don't even know what that is. Well, we're going to inform you. We're going to tell you. We're going to let you know. Joining us today is Alan Wald. He is the head of operations for Ammunition Hill. This is a National Heritage Center right there in Israel. And he has served his country for many, many years as an officer in several elite IDF units. He has also served in the Israeli Secret Service, and he oversaw security operations in Israeli embassies and aviation services around the world. You have a very distinguished career, Alan. Welcome.
Oh, I do not admit anything. Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, we are just so happy to have you here to talk about something that is near and dear to your heart, and that is something called Ammunition Hill, which is connected to the 1967 war. So I want to talk about that because there's a lot of our listeners who don't know what the 1967 war is. And so I know you're going to weave that in and out of this conversation, but what's Ammunition Hill, the historical significance and everything behind that? And where's that at in Israel?
In Israel, you do not need to explain it because Ammunition Hill is a very famous song. From the mouth of the soldiers, it was rhymed and it's every Israeli knows it. It stands for the reunification of Jerusalem. It's actually a battlefield, intact exactly as it was 57 years ago when the paratroopers of the IDF stormed into this stronghold. 4.5 hours, one of the toughest battles the paratroopers ever faced during the 77 years of our existence, against all odds, outnumbered, no artillery support, no aerial support, no intelligence. They came out victorious. And when the government of Israel realized what they did, they decided to seize the moment to confront the United Nations, United States, Soviet Union then, and send a message to one platoon, an order to one platoon commanding officer. Blast open the Lion's Gate, and the rest is history. Jerusalem was reunified, and this was actually the beginning of my life. I was clueless. I was a 10-month baby, without even realizing remotely what kind of a burden lies on my shoulders. The Six-Day War is one of 8 full-scale wars we face in Israel. The first one was the Independence War. And try to imagine, a young nation just rose from the ashes of the Holocaust, trying to build a home for the Jewish people. And once again, a coalition of the Arab nations was formed, making a vow all over the available media. This is media. It was then only black and white television, a little bit of radio. And the spokesman of Nasser, the president of Egypt, made a vow, Jews were going to storm into Palestine, we're going to throw you to the sea, we're going to finish whatever Hitler could not have achieved. Now, I was out of the equation. I don't remember anything, but my mother told me years afterwards that the people of Israel were terrified. It felt like a second Holocaust is going to fall on our heads. And she said to the little me at the age of 8, me and Granny dug trenches in front of our homes in the city of Rishon LeZion and Kfar Saba. But she said to me something else. She said I was even more afraid than the others because I knew that your father had another profession. He was a carpenter. He was your father. He was the love of my life, but he was also a combat engineer specialist of the 55th Brigade. You know, in Israel, most of the men have another profession. 80% of the fighting units, whenever a full-scale war falls on our heads, are not the regular IDF, amazing IDF, that is really one of the toughest armies in the world. But if you need to confront 7 Arab nations, 4 Arab nations, 2, choose the war, they are not enough. Whenever we need to do that, we summon the reservists. It's a notion in Israel. And we know them. It could be your rabbi, your teacher, accountants, lawyers, fresh grooms, proud young fathers who have to make time and again this click I'm looking. It's radio, but it's a click that someone must have made to leave his newborn son and his career and students for the greater good. Where does it come from? This question is woven into my life because my father left me for the greater good. And this is the beginning of my life, an epic triumph against all odds, a miraculous triumph, but a father absent in my life who made a choice. He didn't have to go. He was a civilian. Why did he do it? Didn't he love me? this is the beginning of my life.
Well, you are, of course, preserving the legacy of your father, but not just your father, but all those that, you know, fought in the 1967 war, and especially for the reunification of Jerusalem. So can you just summarize, just real briefly, you know, we talked about the 1967 war, and again, those of you who are listening may not know all the particulars, but this really could have been a devastating situation for Israel. So just kind of give a visual. You guys were surrounded, what was going on, maybe just a little politically, but however you want to describe the 67 war that led up to what happened at Ammunition Hill.
Israel then was a very narrow state. And the corridor to Jerusalem was surrounded from all sides by the Jordanians, legionaries. We had a big army in the north threatening us. This is in the Golan Heights in Lebanon, the Syrian army. In the south, the Egyptian army, who was a very big and very strong army. And in the east, the longest border we have were the Jordanians. So this was actually the beginning of the war when half of the IDF was deployed to the north to block the Syrians. Half of the IDF was deployed to the south to confront the Egyptians. And who could Rabin, the chief of staff, bring to the long, long front in front of the Jordanians, if not three brigades of clickers, civilians, 2 weeks before? This is all what we have. And the war started. It lasted 6 days only. Try to imagine the shift a nation faces when you shift from the edge of annihilation to an epic triumph. When you triple the size of Israel after 6 days, and tens of thousands of Jewish people dancing in front of the Western Wall, shofarot, rabbis, media, they were all there. I heard from very old Americans who came to Ammunition Hill that doctors, physicians, veterans of the United States Army rushed to the airports wanting to save Israel, begging for tickets to Israel, and they told them, stop, it's not needed. What do you mean it's not needed? It's over. 6 days. There's no precedent in the world. We are the only nation in the modern era that within 6 days made a shift and returned to the temple, Western Wall, Jewish quarters, and rose from this war a strong, powerful nation in the Middle East. All the trouble started then, you know, Judea and Samaria, but we just wanted to live. By the way, nobody wanted to liberate Jerusalem. It was a status quo ever since 1948. At the end of the Independence War, two generals, our patched eye, Moshe Dayan, was from our side. And from the Jordanian side, there was Abu Tal, the general. And they said to themselves, let's end this ordeal. I need to finish the war. You, Moshe Dayan, want a country to your people. Let's sign an agreement. Let's not leave it to the politicians. They opened a map over the hood of an army jeep and chopped Jerusalem 8.5 kilometers to two cities. This is the divided Jerusalem. Dayan realized, I'm leaving the Kotel, the Western Wall, the Jewish quarters, the Temple Mount in the other side, but for the sake of existence, he decided to cut a deal, and this was the beginning. And for 19 years, Jerusalem was divided into two cities. In the north side of Jerusalem lied Ammunition Hill. Whoever wanted to control Jerusalem, occupy Jerusalem, protect Jerusalem, the last 4,000 years of its existence, Crusaders, Ottomans, Turkish, Muslims, empires like the Roman Empire realized that Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. So whoever wanted to protect the Holy Crate, you know, where all the monotheistic religions lie today, he knew he has to take the Northern Arch to protect it. It starts at Ammunition Hill, Givat HaMivtar, French Hill, and then Mount Scopus, the famous Mount Scopus. This arch was manned by the Jordanians, best of the best units. Ammunition Hill was overlooking to the border, which was 300 meters of no man's land, very fortified minefields, and for 19 years they were waiting for the inevitable, because eventually something was supposed to happen. We didn't want to launch it, but when the war started, the only order the army received, block the Jordanians from entering the Israeli side of Jerusalem. Nobody had any anticipations to mess with the Muslim world and to occupy or liberate or unite Jerusalem. The paratroopers, including my father, when they came, didn't realize that within 2.5 days they're going to become part of history. They just wanted to protect the civilians of the west side of Jerusalem.
Well, take us into that battle, you know, in 1967 at Ammunition Hill. You just did a great description of where that is in Jerusalem. So tell us about maybe some of the particulars of what happened on that day when they actually reunified Jerusalem.
The pivotal battle that made a difference was this. Because King Hussein made sure that the Bedouin tribe of Al-Hussein would be there. They were more afraid than King Hussein, that they were afraid of death. The paratroopers were supposed to paraglide, to jump, to parachute in the south, in front of the Egyptian army. But when the war started, and this is the issue of the Six-Day War. The government of Israel heard for 2 weeks all these threats, and they said, never again, we had the Holocaust, we are not going to be butchered. So they decided to send 196 combat airplanes, very secretly. Until today, they teach it in armies all over the world. It was a bright decision, and they flew very low over the Mediterranean Sea. People of the city of Ashkelon told us they saw one fleet after the other flying to the south. What's going on? It was a preemptive strike. The Air Force demolished all of the active airplanes of the Egyptian army on the ground. It was brilliant. It was brave. It was amazing, but couldn't have been helped. Within 2.5 hours, war started. We ignited it. We had no choice. So the paratroopers were not needed in the south. So they told them, okay, 2,000 paratroopers, hop on 136 buses, go to Jerusalem. We'll find something to do with you. So from 19 days of planning a very, very complicated assault, they had 5 hours to go to Jerusalem. And they told them, there is this stronghold. This is your mission. Go there. They had no intelligence, no aerial support, because it was night. This is the IDF. 57 years ago, these jets could not be accurate. And Jewish people, the army, has the moral code. They might offend civilians. Artillery, the same deal. Wait for the morning, they beg for them. No, we need to do it now, because from the Jericho, from the Dead Sea, a whole brigade of Jordanians are climbing to Jerusalem. It will be a massacre in the morning. Let us do it tonight. So 5 hours. They had no idea. 3 times more than the protectors of Ammunition Hill were there than they were supposed to be. Normally, when you assault, it has to be 3 versus 1. It was actually 1 versus 1, which the odds were unbelievably tough. And one battalion, paratroopers, very well trained, good friends. They all knew each other because they're all reservists. They all fought years before for our safety and liberty, received the mission. And I am reminding you, there were civilians 2 weeks before, all of them, fathers, husbands, carpenters, lawyers. Now they made a shift and they are storming 2 a.m. into this stronghold, only to realize the best of the best are waiting for them. They knew the place, the Jordanians, like the palm of their hands. And I'm talking about 4.5 hours of a tough, creative, vicious battle face to face, every junction. It started as a platoon, as a snake going into a claustrophobical maze of trenches. And then you see a junction, 2 to the left, 4 to the right, T-junction, V-junction. The big story of Ammunition Hill is a story of 2 platoons spread all over the place when they are fighting of 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 people scattered all over 16 acres of a battlefield. They had no idea what's going on. And I told them, so how did you win? One of my friends of my father asked him, I know the battle. I can recite it and know exactly what were the... How did you win? He said to me 2 things. He said, one thing, when I fought in a place which is very famous, the big bunker, 3 privates received 3 medals of valor there. We were utterly convinced that what we do here, bravery, leadership, courage, creativity, our friends 10 meters from us are doing the same. This was the bonding of this unit. And he said to me another thing which ignited my life and the questions I posed later on. He said, you really want to know how we won? Come to my hometown, to Yokneam, see my wife and you understand everything. When I was fighting in the Sinai Peninsula and in Jerusalem all through my army career, she grew up 8 amazing kids. She took care of the farm. She is brave as I am. And I came and I saw Hani, his wife, and I understood everything. They saw it. They could see it. They could see the old city of Jerusalem. But the mission was to liberate the people that manned Mount Scopus. It was a library. It was a university. It was a hospital. For these 19 years, with the acceptance of the United Nations and a special agreement with the Jordanians, it was an isolated island. And these people, the Israeli people, treated Palestinians and Arabs and Jordanians in the hospital. But they knew if the war will start, they will be butchered. So the mission was to go to Mount Scopus towards the Judea desert, towards the east. Jerusalem was in the south, but nobody wanted to touch it. But the colonel, commanding officer of the paratroopers, Colonel Montagu, he positioned himself on Mount of Olives. And he literally, after the battle ended, from the east side, he's the first conqueror from the east ever of Jerusalem. And he begged the government, please, all the stars are aligned. It will never happen again. 2,000 years we waited. Give me the order. And during the 6th of June night, the night after the Battle of Ammunition Hill, the coalition, the government of Israel, in the bunker of our parliament, the Knesset, were arguing, should we seize the moment? It's a problem. because we might confront, ignite all of the Muslim world, but they were so persuasive. And the Battle of Ammunition Hill was something that persuaded them to seize the moment. And the order was given 7th of June in the morning, 10:15. Like politicians do it. It's not an army order. Should the circumstances forces you to make a decision, you are allowed to consider to enter the old city of Jerusalem. This is everything they needed. So 10:15 in the morning, Mota Gur, the colonel of the paratroopers, he taking his radio, his head a little bit shook because he knew what he's going to say. It was not an army order. You guys, we waited for 2,000 years. All the Jewish nation are waiting for us. One platoon commanding office, two tanks, blast open the Lion's Gate, move out, move out, move out. And Yoram Zamush is this platoon commanding officer. He's alive until today. I consider him to be one of my fathers, collective fathers. Blast open the Lion's Gate. He runs all through the Temple Mount, only to see the Moroccan gate. A very old Arab guy awaits for them with a big key on his chest. In broken Hebrew, he says, I knew you'll arrive eventually. Take it. And Yoram Zamush opens the Moroccan gates, looks to the side, and sees the Western Wall. You know, for 2,000 years, people waited. We had to ask for quotas, permission from the Crusaders, the Muslims. Now we are here. And the first thing he does, you know what he does? He takes the Israeli flag, which her grandmother in the west side of Jerusalem gave it to him 2 days before. It was in his rear pouch. He takes it out and says to the troops, go down. I'm going to go up. I'm going to hang the flag. Six soldiers, deputy commanding officer Yoram Zamush, are taking the flag. And they are, before they hang the flag, they are writing on the flag, we are the paratroopers, A platoon, 71st battalion, 55th brigade, 10:15 a.m., the biblical date, are hanging the flag on the Western Wall, and they are saluting, they all shook with their hands, singing our national anthem, Hatikva, crying, and the deputy commanding officer says to his ear, listen, Zamush, we will never live here again. You listen to me. We will never live here again. It was a very emotional moment. We have the fort at Ammunition Hill. We have the story, and we have the flag. He kept it all through his life, and when he realized what we are doing there now is a very meaningful educational asset and heritage site, he came to us and he gave us this flag that the old grandmother gave to him. It was the flag that was she took from the Jewish quarters in 1948 when the Jordanians threw her away with her kids and family from their homes. Only one thing she took, a flag. And she gave it to him before the war, and it's now at Ammunition Hill. People need to come and see it. It's amazing.
It is amazing. The story is incredible. And Alan Wald, of course, is the director of Ammunition Hill, the Heritage Center there. And if you ever get to Israel, as you're listening today, and I hope you'll plan on making a trip to Israel, you need to put Ammunition Hill on your agenda. Jerusalem, once again, reunified. Jerusalem is the capital of the Jewish people. What does that mean to you as a Jewish man?
Sure, it makes me very proud. I'm working on a daily basis in a unified Jerusalem in an air-conditioned office which is located 56 meters from the place my father was killed. Every morning I'm coming from my hometown to the management parking lot and I see the place. I not always think about it, but this is the adjacent bush. And I remember the age of 13 when his friend so proud told me exactly how my father was killed. So when I'm driving in Jerusalem, I see something remarkable. I see that we gave it literally back to the world because anybody can come to this united Jerusalem and do whatever he wants as long as he does not offend others. All the monotheistic religions, all the other sects can come as long as they do not offend others. They can do it. You cannot imagine walking through the old city. You can see so many mosques, so many churches, so many religious, so many, and it's okay. I do not judge anybody, but so many thousands of years, people said it's ours. You need to humble yourself because the Lord, the God looks at us. And for me, my father gave me something. I cannot bring him from the dead, but I can make sense of his sacrifice in a way. And by the way, my English does not come from family or anything. I'm an Israeli boy. Because I felt compelled to tell the story that to people that come from all over the world. The last 14 years, I taught myself to speak English. It sounds better in Hebrew, but people listen to me because I'm telling the truth. But if you ask the same question to a child, I was angry with my father. I had no idea what does it mean, Jerusalem. Jerusalem took my father from me. I was the only kid in class without a father, and every other month I saw another daddy coming to brag about his amazing career, in front of my classmates, and I saw his daughter or son looking at the father so proud, and there was the little me envying them all. Why? Why do they all have fathers and I do not have one? And every Memorial Day, every Independence Day, every Jerusalem Day, when all the nation is marveling the reunification of Jerusalem, the principal used to point at me. His father was brave, and I was angry. And this is an issue that started my life. I wanted to know him, and I can tell you honestly here, so many thousands of miles from my hometown, that I wanted to forgive him. I wanted to know that he had no other choice. And the guys who gave me everything I needed to know are his friends who literally adopted me and all of the orphans of Ammunition Hill 57 years ago. When they were supposed to marvel the reunification of Jerusalem, to dance and chant to be admired, they left everything, knock on my doorstep and said to my mother, maybe Alonchik, my nickname, lost a father, here 10 alternative, uncles, friends, he will never step alone anymore. And to these guys, I was privileged enough to ask all the tough questions I had to ask. Didn't my father love me? Didn't you love your families? Why the hell did you go once, time and again? What does it mean, actually, war? I had no idea. Jerusalem. So sitting here with you today, I'm proud of him. I know he had no other choice. I know he was utterly convinced he's saving my life and the life of my mother and the people of Israel when he sniffed my head for the last time, gave me to my grandfather, guard my son, and left. I know him because I'm a major in the IDF. I'm an officer. I'm a father myself. I need to go to the army. My daughters go to the army. We hate war, but we need to be proud of the legacy they left to us.
That is an incredible story. And I just want to add this, the dedication, the sacrifices of these men in the 1967 war and all of the wars of Israel. Obviously, the sacrifices for the state of Israel and for the Jewish people. But I'm going to add this. It's also a sacrifice for us here in the United States because of what you do to fight terrorism, what you do to hold back the evil forces of the world who want to destroy the Jewish state and then just really come to the United States and destroy the United States. So all of the people that are serving in the IDF and the military and the sacrifices that have been made, it's also for those of us here in the United States. And I think that's a really good thing for all of us to realize as we're listening here to this Middle East report, that the sacrifices that they made, it really benefits us as well here in this country. And I think, to me, that's just absolutely amazing. Ammunition Hill there in Jerusalem would be an incredible place for anybody to visit, Alon. And I just want to encourage people to go there. So if somebody puts that on their agenda and wants to visit Ammunition Hill, what are they going to see when they get to Ammunition Hill?
Beautiful, amazing, big entrance hall, and there you will be offered an option. We are addressing the future. We know the span of attention of kids is limited, so you can put headsets, choose one of six languages, hear the story. The duration is maximum 90 seconds, animations, movies, clips. You have an intact battlefield. You can walk through the trenches. It's amazing, claustrophobic maze of trenches, but nobody bad awaits for you there. A beautiful memorial hall and also a 3D diorama. 19 minutes you can see on a replica of Jerusalem, 3D replica. What happened in Jerusalem 2.5 days, 57 years ago? It's amazing. And I will be there. I'm there on a daily basis. Be more than glad to host people. And you mentioned something in the end. We are winning the wars. We are tough, but we are losing the media. And we need you guys to tell the truth and help us resonate. Because indeed, the evil will not stop there. See what's going on in Europe. It's a different story. We do not hate the Arabs. We coexist amazingly with the Muslims. Half of my labor at Ammunition Hill are Palestinians. I'm going to go back to Israel to break bread with them, to eat hummus, bring from the duty-free chocolates. We can do it.
Alon, thank you so much for the work that you do to preserve Ammunition Hill and to inform people about the truth of the 1967 war. I encourage you to find out more about Ammunition Hill. You can Google that, and you can also find out about the history of the 1967 war. And if you're in Israel, you need to visit Ammunition Hill. Hey, as we wrap up this edition of the Middle East Report, I want to share with you another Hebrew word and what's behind that Hebrew word from my good friend, Shani Ferguson in Israel.
Shalom from Jerusalem. I'm Shani Ferguson, and I'm here with your Hebrew word of the day. You know, Hebrew is this fascinating language that inspires a lot of people to want to learn it, even though they won't necessarily use it in their everyday life because the scriptures were written in Hebrew. Of course, we're talking ancient Hebrew, but it is a mysterious language. in terms of the depth that words can have. And yet grammatically, it's very, very simple. And today we will be discussing the most commonly used Hebrew word of all time. Now, if you're thinking of the word hallelujah, you could be right, as it has been adopted into so many languages throughout the world. But in terms of the most commonly used words spoken in Hebrew, that word is shalom. The word shalom is both a simple and complex word. At face value, it means peace. As a word that means peace, you can imagine how often the word is discussed in the Middle East. If you ever visit Israel, you'll see stickers and political signs with the word shalom on them, declaring their stated goal of the absence of violence between peoples or nations. Kind of a pursuit of, can't we all just get along? But this word is so much more. You'll find that the word shalom is spoken in virtually every conversation, mostly to greet people with a blessing when they say both hello and goodbye. Jewish culture and traditions are full of occasions to bless each other, like the phrase shalom or shalom aleichem means peace be upon you or peace be with you. The blessing of shalom is something we like to speak over each other, as it covers both inner peace and peace in relationships with those around you and before the Lord. Shalom is simultaneously the most basic and greatest blessing that you can speak over someone. I mean, think about it. You can bless someone with riches and you can bless them with long life, but they don't have that peace inside of them, they won't be able to fully enjoy those other blessings. And if they have neither riches nor long life, the inner peace they enjoy will suffice. Shalom comes from the Hebrew root shin lamed mem. Those three letters spell the word shalem, meaning whole. So it makes sense that the inner peace comes from a place of inner wholeness. Another interesting word that comes from the same root is shilem, meaning paid for. So as believers, when we bless each other with shalom, our prayer is that those we bless will experience the peace Yeshua promised, not the kind the world gives, but the peace that passes all understanding, the kind that comes with eternal life. So from Jerusalem all the way to your home, I bless you with shalom.
That's the Middle East Report. Get a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcast. We are on all the major podcast platforms. Just search for The Middle East Report and you'll find it on Spotify, Podbean, all the major podcast platforms. Or you can go to afr.net and download it there. Thanks for listening. I'm John Riley.